Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Okay, guys. And literally this time I mean guys. Guys, for all the men listening right now, what is the one thing that dwells in each and every one of the 30 trillion cells in your body that defines you as the male of the species? I'll give you a second or two here to think about it. Okay, maybe you didn't even need that long because it's kind of an easy question, right? It's the Y chromosome, of course. So you'd think that back in 2003, when former President Bill Clinton announced,
"We are here to celebrate the completion of the first survey of the entire human genome. Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by humankind."
Well, you would have thought that Clinton meant the entire human genome. Turns out, the map wasn't exactly complete. More than 10% of human DNA was missing from that first map, notably a detailed, complete decoding of the Y chromosome. Which is kind of odd to me, because when you think about it, the Y is a chromosome in the bodies of 50% of the entire human race. Well, 20 years later, the Y chromosome is finally getting its due. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Y is the tiniest human chromosome. It's the short, stubby counterpart to the X chromosome. Adam Phillippe admits it's kind of odd that it hasn't been fully sequenced until now.
You wouldn't expect it to, because it's the smallest chromosome. So, you know, why would it take the longest to finish the smallest chromosome?
Phillippe is a senior investigator at the National Human Genome Research Institute at the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. In August of this year, he and his team published a paper in the journal Nature describing the first complete successful sequencing of the Y chromosome. So back to his question, why did it take so long? Well, Phillippe says it's something to do with what geneticists call repeats.
Repeats are exactly what they sound like. It's a piece of DNA that has a certain sequence, and that sequence is repeated over and over and over, sometimes for millions of bases or characters. And anytime you're putting together a puzzle, figuring out the repeats is always the hardest part because all of the pieces look the same.
Okay, so let's lay it out as clearly as possible. First, you have to sequence the DNA or figure out what each piece of the genome says. Then you have to assemble those pieces in the right order. So for the Y chromosome, Phillippe's team already knew the sequence. They just needed to figure out how to fit those pieces together. So let's go back to imagining that puzzle he was talking about. Like, say it's an actual puzzle on a table in front of you. Phillippe's talking about a ton of pieces that have the same color, like blue for the sky. But those pieces are different shapes, and they only fit together in a certain way. You know they're all blue, and you know they all fit together, but you're not exactly sure how.
When the Human Genome Project was initiated and completed in the early 2000s, they could only sequence a few hundred bases at a time. So the pieces were much, much smaller 20 years ago, and so small that it was really an impossible problem. So they just shoved all of those blue pieces to the side and left them as a big heap.
So Phillippe's talking about a giant heap of microscopic, tiny blue puzzle pieces. Pretty daunting. But in 2020, The team was using a technology called an assembler. It's basically a machine that can sort through those confusing puzzle pieces. And it looked like the team was on the verge of a breakthrough.
We looked at the results on the screen, like a visualization of how well the assembler is doing, and it was putting everything together in a way that we had never seen before. Much more complete, much more continuous, and it was really an aha moment. And we saw that visualization and thought, wow, we can actually do this. And we kind of then took everybody in the lab, all hands on deck.
Roughly 2 years later, they succeeded. Philippi's team had finally cracked the code of the full human Y chromosome, that final missing piece in the complete human genome sequence. And as I mentioned, their findings were just published in the journal Nature in August of 2023.
I think what the most important takeaway from this study is that we can now do it at all from end to end, you know, from telomere to telomere, as we call it.
So what is there to discover across the Y chromosome between those telomere brackets, as I call them? Well, what could the complete Y chromosome mean for understanding things like cancer risk, male fertility, or biology in general? That's what we want to look at today. And Pila Hallest joins us. She's a research scientist at the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine, and she's taken Philippi's team's research a step further. She's completely sequenced 43 Y chromosomes from men across the world. Pila, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So first of all, I would actually like to talk with you, before we discuss your research, a little bit more about the fundamental importance of the Y chromosome itself. Like, what are the kinds of things that it determines in human beings?
So the most important function of the human Y chromosome is essentially determining the biological gender. So when the human embryo starts developing, if it has the Y chromosome present, it will develop a testis, but if the Y chromosome is not present, the embryo will develop an ovary, meaning that a girl will be born.
Mm. So it determines the sex of a fetus and therefore of a person later on. There are also a lot of sex-linked traits, actually, right, that are dependent on what either is present or not present on the Y chromosome.
So many of these traits have not been directly associated with the Y chromosome. We know that there are major differences between males and females in terms of susceptibility to different diseases or disorders, the frequency, the outcome, but we don't necessarily know that this is driven by the Y chromosome or the composition of the Y chromosome.
Okay.
So this still remains to be discovered in many cases, because one thing which complicates it is that if we have a biological male and the male has a testis, the testis produces androgens, male sex hormones, and they produce testosterone. So the composition of hormones between males and male and females is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to actually understand how much of these differences are coming specifically from the presence or absence of the Y chromosome, and how much is coming from differences in the hormonal environment in these specific individuals. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, thank you for that clarification, because you're speaking about hormonal differences between males and females. We will come back to that in a moment, Pila, but I guess what I was referencing, and I apologize for not being as clear as possible, but about sex-linked traits such as colorblindness or, I think, hemophilia. I'm digging back to my middle school and high school biology here, that the presence of or the lack or presence of certain genes on the Y chromosome in comparison to the X chromosome can lead men to having certain traits or factors more often than women. Isn't that right, or am I wrong? Okay, it looks like we have dropped her line. She's in Cambridge in the United Kingdom today. So we're going to come back to Pila Hallest in just a moment. But also joining us now is Richard Reeves. He's president of the American Institute for Boys and Men and author of the book Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. Richard, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. But I think you just misgendered me there.
I know. I said she, and then I corrected it and said he, so I'm so sorry about that.
That is perfectly fine.
I should just be settled with, he's a human, male of the species.
That's
who
right.
joins us today. Pila back on the show in just a moment. Apparently the line to the UK is obviously not working in our favor. But Richard, I wanted to invite you on the program today, obviously because the past several years of your career you have devoted to studying and investigating sort of the plight or the condition of men and boys in this country. So tell me a little bit about just your first thoughts of, okay, well, now we have this sequence. We're going to understand a little bit more of what it means. This sequence of the Y chromosome. Do you think that's a breakthrough for understanding men more broadly?
Well, obviously, at a scientific level, it's important. And I'm very interested, for example, in the fact that some of the receptors that helped with COVID were actually found more on the Y than on the X. And so I think that we might just understand more about some diseases, as you've already alluded to. And I'd be interested to hear, I think you've got Pila back now. Are there other things we might learn in terms of the different susceptibility just at a biological level between men and women from understanding the Y chromosome? So I think there's a broader conversation we might get into around masculinity, how far our genes or even our hormones, as you were just discussing, determine who we are as males and females. It's a broader question. But I think it's exciting just to understand the scientific implications of this to start with, and then we can maybe have a better conversation about the culture of masculinity.
Mm-hmm. So we will do that, and I do think we have Pila back, but I'm going to wait. We just have a minute before our first break, so I'm going to actually take advantage of that time. And Richard, ask you, there's always the tension, that nature-nurture tension, right? Do you think that, and we're all actually quite a bit enamored with what we think genetics can tell us about human beings. You know, sometimes I think we look to it as an absolutist form of an answer. Are you concerned that the more we understand about what's on the Y, that might happen in understanding masculinity more broadly?
Yeah, and I think the danger can go two ways. In one way, do you remember the search for the so-called gay gene?
Mm-hmm.
And this sense of like, if we can just prove this at a biological level, then that will be better. My sense is that we've shown that's not true, and that there's so much diversity of human experience and human identity that looking for a genetic or even sometimes just a biological explanation for human behavior only takes you so far, and it turns out not that far.
Yeah.
And so there isn't an allele or a gene for understanding misogyny, or Andrew Tate, the fun online influencer.
Tate allele. Okay.
Like, there's no Tate allele.
Right? I love that.
I'm not a scientist.
Thank God.
But I'm sure.
There's no Andrew Tate allele. But Richard Reeves, stand by and thank you for saving us on this technologically challenged Friday. I was thinking it's been such a long but great week. We're going to sail into the weekend. But no, keeping us on our toes is technology. So we'll be back in a moment. And Pila Hallest will be back with us as well. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the Y chromosome. It is the last human chromosome to be fully sequenced, and it just happened, or in a paper published just this August. I'm joined today by Richard Reeves. He's president of the American Institute for Boys and Men, and Pila Hallest is with us. Knock on wood, on a better line. She's a research scientist at the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine and is first author of a study that sequenced 43 Y chromosomes from men across the world. Now, Pila, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for your patience while we worked out all those technical problems. So I want to go back to the question that I was asking you before our line cut off, and that is, again, some Y chromosome basics. I was hoping that you might remind me or correct me about whether things like color blindness, hemophilia, and some other sex-linked diseases or traits are exclusive to men because of the Y chromosome. Is that right?
Well, to be honest, they're not really caused by genes on the Y chromosome, as far as we know. But because men have one X chromosome, this is why there are so many sex-linked diseases. So essentially, they have only one X chromosome left, and the X chromosome contains many different genes which are responsible for many different functions. So if something goes wrong with that last remaining gene copy on the X chromosome, then this is where the issues come from. Females have two X chromosomes, so it kind of the second X chromosome can kind of save the situation.
Yes.
Classically, what we know is that some men have very hairy ears, and this phenotype has been associated with the Y chromosome. So it has been a textbook example for a long time of a Y chromosome linked trait. But then more recent work has actually shown that this is also not necessarily a Y linked phenotype. Again, it is actually influenced by other genes in the genome. So in that respect, it's quite difficult to pinpoint exact phenotypes which are related to the Y chromosome.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense because, of course, everything is much more complicated than you learn in elementary or secondary school. But I guess what I was referring to is exactly what you were saying, that you know, the X chromosome is so big and so large that it can sometimes contain, let's say, what would usually be a recessive gene for something. And because men don't have another X chromosome, they just have the Y. If the Y is lacking, I guess the dominant gene that would have been found on another X chromosome, that recessive trait can be expressed. So that was kind of what I was trying to get to. But let's move on to the decoding, the fully decoding of the Y chromosome now. Can you tell me your opinion about why it took so long, an additional 20 years, to do that when it is, in fact, the smallest chromosome in the human genome?
So it comes back to the repeat composition of the Y chromosome. So as Adam also mentioned, the Y chromosome is highly repetitive. So if you basically take and sum up all these highly similar repeats in the Y chromosome, you can easily say that 75-80% of the whole chromosome is highly repetitive. And with the old sequencing technologies, which had shorter read length, less than 1,000 base pairs, it was just very difficult to piece these sequences back together in the right order and orientation. So now we have reached the point that we can sequence very large fragments. So the novel and quite new long-read sequencing technologies, they can generate sequence fragments which are 20,000 base pairs in size and also more than 100,000 base pairs in size. So if you think about it, it's just, if you have tiny pieces of 1,000 base pairs compared to large pieces of 20,000 or 100,000 pieces in length, then of course it completely changes how you can piece things together and how accurately. So this has been a complete game changer in the genomics.
Okay.
And of course, with the coming of these long-read sequencing technologies, we also needed new software tools that can actually assemble genomes accurately. And this is also an ongoing effort now, but Adam Philippi's group has done a great job at coming up with these new tools that can actually assemble genomes very, very well and very accurately.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying that there's actually more, there are many more repeats in the Y chromosome than I suppose in the X. First of all, is that right? And second of all, is the fact of the existence of the high number of repeats significant in understanding what the Y chromosome does?
So the X chromosome definitely contains a lot less repeats. And actually, the Y chromosome in the human genome is by far the most repeat-rich chromosome. So it's in its own, it's a completely different genetic entity, I guess you could say so, because it's so different in the sequence composition and repeat composition.
And so can you tell me if that's significant in terms of understanding perhaps, the greater influence that the Y chromosome has on male biology or not? I mean, is it maybe too early to even ask that question?
I would say it's even a bit too early. So for a long time, people thought that these kinds of repetitive regions were essentially junk and they did nothing. But I think that unless we look, we don't really know. So we know by now that in the human genome, there are repetitive regions which do have important functions and they do influence traits and disease outcomes and all sorts of things. But with the Y chromosome, essentially large parts, more than half of the Y chromosome sequence was missing until now from the reference genome.
So we
have not been able to study it. Maybe it does something, maybe it does not, maybe it doesn't do anything, but we just haven't been able to look into it properly.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never understood why there may be such large chunks of the genome that are, let me put it this way, empty of meaning to us right now. Because it's hard for me to imagine that any set of base pairs after billions of years of evolution wouldn't have some kind of purpose. But it's interesting to me that we can't quite yet figure out what the supposedly junk parts of the genome do. But Pila, so, and Richard, I promise I'll get back to you here. Feel free to jump in anytime with a question if you have one. But I just wanted to get a little bit more of the science laid out before us. So Pila, you then went ahead and actually sequenced 43 Y chromosomes from men across the world, different continents, different races, et cetera. What was revealed to you with the additional sequencing of so many more Y chromosomes from different kinds of men?
So what surprised me the most was essentially the high level of size and structural variation. We know quite a lot about the Y chromosome, despite the fact that the reference was incomplete, from studies which were made in the 80s, 90s, even 70s. So, for example, we do know that the size varies, but what was very surprising to me was we only sequenced 43 Y chromosomes, and yet we saw such a huge range of variation. So just the size of the Y chromosome among a relatively small sample size, let's be honest, ranged from 45 million base pairs to 85 million base pairs. And maybe even more interestingly, roughly a quarter of the whole Y chromosome composition, especially in the regions which contain genes, important genes for testicular functions, spermatogenesis, they basically flip in orientation. And they also contain additional large-scale structural variations. So some of these variations we knew about, but what we now have accomplished is really the base pair level understanding of these regions,
yeah.
The base pair level representation. So this now gives us the possibility to go a step further and try to understand, okay, if we see this sort of variation, what does it do? Again, maybe it does nothing, but I'm pretty sure it does something.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I would. I'd stake money on that right now, Pila. But let me go back to something you said. So you said that in the 43 Y chromosomes that you studied, you found a very, very powerful fundamental variation in the sheer number of base pairs from 40 million to 80 million. So some of these Y chromosomes had double the number of base pairs. That seems amazing to me. Do we see the same variability in the number of base pairs in X chromosomes?
No, absolutely not. The X chromosome is, of course, much larger. It's roughly 150 million base pairs in size. And of course, there are repetitive regions which vary in size between individuals, but nothing to that extent. And this is also true for the other human chromosomes. None of the human chromosomes vary in size to such extent.
Just the Y.
Just the Y.
That's kind of mind-blowing. Okay, again, this is so new that I don't expect you to have answers. But then what are some of the questions that are raised in your mind from the sheer fact of this base pair variability in the Y chromosome? What else would you like to learn about the what that variability means?
So there are many questions. I think the main question I would like to focus on is, what does this variation do? Does it do anything? Because as I mentioned, even in the regions which do contain genes that code proteins, which are, for example, important in spermatogenesis, we see extensive variation in the sequence composition. Many of these regions are in different orientation. We have copy number variations, you know, some in some men, some regions have more copies than in others. So there are so many different questions that we could be asking. So as I mentioned as well before, we knew about many of these structural variants, but now that we have the sequence resolution, I really do believe that this will help to explain at least some of these variable phenotypes that we see as well. So maybe if we see kind of the similar structure across different men, but maybe the exact breakpoint where something happened is actually different. But we didn't know this before. We couldn't determine it before because we didn't have the full sequence, but we can do it now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, Pila, stand by for just a moment because, Richard, you've been listening very patiently, and I hope you can forgive me just nerding out on some of the details here of Pila's research. But I don't know if you have any response or reaction to what she's been sharing so far.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, there, of course, in some ways, this can just make for great copy or great jokes, right? What we're hearing is that the male chromosome is short, repetitive, and a bit confused. and we hear scientists like Pilar saying, does it do anything? And you actually, in science fiction, there's like the Y, the last man, there's this sense that maybe the Y will disappear and so on too. So, and that's one reaction. At a more serious level, though, I am very interested in understanding how it interacts with things like hormone expression, which in turn interacts with behavior. I have a question for maybe Pilar can help with this. One of the things that we've struggled to understand is the huge difference in mortality rates from COVID-19, for example. And as far as my science takes me, which is not very far, it looks like there's something about the expression of ACE2 receptors on, so I'm nerding out now, but on the Y, much more so than on the X. And so could it be that even something like the much higher death rate, so in the US, for example, twice as many middle-aged men died from COVID as middle-aged women, and globally there was at least a 50% higher risk of death. Pilar, is that something that we would hope to understand, some of the differences in the responses to diseases as well from understanding the chromosomes better?
I do think so, yes. So, for example, there was a paper recently in June published in Nature as well, which showed that the loss of Y chromosome makes a huge difference how invasive is bladder cancer in men who have lost the Y chromosome. And also, the loss of the Y chromosome, specifically in the tumor tissue, made these tumors much more prone to a specific treatment. So I think, like, these sorts of studies are now coming up more and more, showing that there is something on the Y chromosome that is also impacting immune responses, cancer development, all these kinds of things. So I think we just need to dig deeper and really try to understand what is the difference. I think there is something on the Y chromosome. Many studies have shown that, for example, the loss of the Y chromosome in men, it makes a huge difference in even life expectancy, risk for different cancers, Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
So somehow, something on the Y is important.
Pila, let me just step in here for just a moment and say, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Can you explain briefly what you mean by the loss of the Y chromosome? I'm a little confused by that.
So it has been known for quite some time now, decades, that aging men lose the Y chromosome in the white blood cells. And this loss of Y chromosome in the blood cells has been associated with many different risk factors, lower life expectancy, as I mentioned. So again, we don't really understand it very well, and it is definitely impacted by environmental factors as well. So, for example, we know that men who smoke, they have a higher risk of losing the Y chromosome, and therefore they're also at a higher risk of all these other increased risks of cancer and Alzheimer's disease.
Oh, Pila, but when you mean when they lose the white blood cells in the Y, when they lose the Y chromosomes in the white blood cells, you mean like the Y chromosome actually just physically is not there in white blood cells from men?
Yes.
Really? How does that happen?
Well, I mean, I guess it happens during the cell division so that the Y chromosome is just lost. I mean, if you think about it, it doesn't necessarily have very important roles in the viability of a human being, I guess. I mean, once it determines the gender, I mean, the individuals can well survive without the Y chromosome.
Wow.
So it's not strictly necessary, but clearly there is something on the Y chromosome that is making it important.
Okay.
But now that we have the full sequences, maybe we can also understand it better. What is it exactly that is making the Y chromosome important?
Richard, are you looking down at your hands or arms right now and wondering what's in your white blood cells at the moment?
I am literally on another screen booking a blood test.
Are you serious?
This is getting more depressed by the moment.
Oh, no. Right,
wait, these things can disappear. But it's also, I think it's also important, like, it's not just at the beginning, right? It's also in adolescence, I think.
Yes.
I think some of the interactions with hormones and environment. And so what's interesting about this is the more we learn about biology, the more important we realize the environment is.
Yeah.
And it makes culture and environment more important, not less important, as we understand how they interact with biology. So there's no like magic gene answer.
No.
And instead, what we learn is that actually how we interact in the world becomes more important the more we understand about biology.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about biology when we come back, but then return to that interaction question too. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are engaging in a fascinating conversation about the Y chromosome. It's the smallest chromosome in the human genome, and it was only recently fully sequenced. So I'm joined today by Pila Hallast. She is a research scientist at the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine. She's the first author of a study that completely sequenced 43 Y chromosomes from men across the world and found some remarkable things about diversity within the Y itself. Richard Reeves joins us as well. He's president of the American Institute for Boys and Men, and he's with us to sort of talk more broadly about the implications of biology and environment when it comes to understanding men and the male condition at any age. But I want to now bring in Dr. Stephen Leslie. He's with us from Omaha, Nebraska, and he's associate professor of urology at the Creighton University School of Medicine. Dr. Leslie, my deep appreciation for your patience and welcome to On Point.
Thank you, and hello, Meg.
So, first of all, as a urologist, give me one or two of the big questions that you would like to ask that understanding the Y chromosome might help answer.
Well, how soon can we find out how to turn on or turn off some of these genes that will actually make a difference in human health and particularly male infertility?
Okay, so why male infertility in particular?
First, that's the main function of the Y chromosome, to create the testes and to determine male physical characteristics as well as healthy sperm. The sperm counts among men worldwide has been declining steadily. And I'm afraid I'm going to make Richard even more depressed. In 1940, the average sperm count was over 110 million sperm per milliliter. In the 1990s, this dropped to 66 million. In 2018, it was around 50 million. And currently, we consider the normal average to be anything over 40. If this continues, eventually we're not going to have a viable amount, number of sperm to continue procreating the human race.
I have read those similar numbers before. We actually have done several shows about the reduction, the dramatic reduction in male fertility worldwide. I want to emphasize that. But Dr. Leslie, what confuses me about this rapid decline is that I didn't think that evolution works on that kind of very tight timeline. Certainly there has to be some kind of environmental piece to this that would so quickly be, if we're presuming that there's something being turned off and on in the Y chromosome, it can't just be evolution. Is there something we're doing to our environment that's having an impact on chromosomal activity in men now?
Well, we're not absolutely sure, but the overwhelming evidence is that exposure to more and more environmental chemicals and toxins, pollution, particularly pesticides, poor diet, COVID-19 didn't help. Obesity tends to affect hormone production and has an effect. Smoking damages the most rapidly reproducing cells, and the cells that make sperm are the fastest growing in the body. And again, Richard's not going to like this either. We now have vastly improved medical care worldwide compared to what we had 50 or 100 years ago. And as wonderful as that is, it's allowing more men with marginal health and borderline genetics and really poor sperm production to reproduce. We have assisted reproductive techniques where we use a lot of high-tech microscopes and inject sperm into eggs and then reimplant them in ladies and all sorts of other fancy things, where in the past, those people who had very marginal sperm counts just could not procreate. Now they're able to, and that just allows marginal genes to remain in the population. And marginal genes don't produce good sperm.
I'm going to come back to this in a second, because thinking about the Y chromosome and the human race more broadly has happened before in the past, and I promise to come back to that. But Pila, first of all, actually, let me turn to you. Because what Dr. Leslie is talking about is, you know, is it plausible that we would, if we don't already know, we would determine where in the Y chromosome the genes for, you know, activating or deactivating spermatogenesis happen, and that perhaps we could, you know, we could tweak those genes to keep them on even in the face of environmental assaults to the Y chromosome, Pila?
I guess it's not impossible, but it will be a long path and a lot of work. I mean, especially if we want to use these kinds of therapies on human beings, it will definitely need a lot of work and a lot of time to make sure that we are not messing something else up while trying to solve one issue, and then maybe we will cause 10 others.
Mm. Well, Richard, since Dr. Leslie mentioned your name quite often, your response to his, you know, his actually pointed and data-based concern about male fertility.
Well, first of all, I need to go. I've got 8 medical tests that I need to go and schedule immediately. But more seriously, this question about declining male fertility is an interesting one, and it's sometimes wrapped up into this whole debate about the decline of men. Do we need men, etc.? But when I've looked at the evidence, and I want to ask Stephen this, I've always thought it's a bit overstated, because even though there's been a big drop and you have dramatic numbers like the ones you just shared, the truth is you just don't need that many. And so, what is it, 66 million or something, but you just don't need that many. And so there's no reason to panic. And there's also no reason to assume the line will keep going down. And so I've come away from that evidence much less concerned than you sound. And so what do you make of the argument that actually, sure, that we've got many fewer, but we've still got millions more than we need?
Well, that's true. Yes, but I mean, in theory, you only really need one, assuming that sperm is really healthy and chooses the right fallopian tube to use. In practice, what we find is anything less than 20 million per ml is really iffy. So as long as we're above that kind of red line threshold, we're probably okay. But since we don't know for sure what the cause is, and we're no further along in correcting it. I have no reason to think that the trend will not continue. And the factors I mentioned, pollution, pesticide, chemical exposure, maintaining a population pool of poorer and poorer genes overall, paradoxically through better medical care. I don't see anything changing that. And therefore, I'm not quite as optimistic as you are. I'm a little concerned that we need to pay attention to this.
So the precautionary principle would suggest better to act now and get ahead of what could potentially be a very bad outcome, i.e. the end of the human race, rather than say, well, we're fine for now. You would say, look, let's try and get ahead of it, figure out what's going on before we get close to that threshold.
Well, I don't see anyone arguing in favor of obesity and smoking and poor health and more pollution or pesticides. We should do a better job in taking care of it now. And what I see happening is that little by little, fewer and fewer men will have sufficient normal sperm counts with enough healthy sperm to have reasonable or normal fertility. And more and more males in the population will either need assisted reproductive techniques or just give up and not have children at all. Hmm. It's going to happen little by little and incrementally, I think.
Well, it does sound, though, that, Dr. Leslie, you're seeing finally the full sequencing of the Y chromosome as the first significant step that could potentially lead to a breakthrough in answering some of these questions about male fertility.
Absolutely. We already know about these environmental factors and the other things I mentioned. Now that we know what the gene sequence is in the Y chromosome, we also know that since it's passed down from father to son and father to son and so on, that it does undergo relatively few mutations. If we can figure out how to stabilize or make it more stable, perhaps it can slow the decline in the sperm count, or maybe even reverse it. We know how to turn on specific areas in genes and turn them off, promote or stop enzymes. We're just at the beginning of that. And I'm hopeful that sometime in the future, we'll be able to fix borderline spermatogenic problems if we can fix the Y chromosome issue that is causing it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stephen Leslie, Associate Professor of Urology at the Creighton University School of Medicine, with us from Omaha, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
And Pila Hallest, Research Scientist at the Jackson Laboratory for Genomic Medicine, who studied the full genome of 43 different Y chromosomes from across the world. Pila, thank you so much for your research and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Richard, I actually wanted to spend the last few minutes of the show with you because we could, of course, have spent the entire time talking about the genomic reality now in terms of better understanding the Y chromosome and the scientific future. But I think we need to get back to what you were saying earlier about the question of biology and environment and how those things actually work together to produce this thing called masculinity at various ages that we're still trying, you know, that we should care more about and think more clearly about. Because I do, well, as much as I love science, I practice a little bit of caution in being sort of a genetic determinist, right? Because in the past, we've looked to the Y chromosome as being, even before we had came anywhere close to sequencing it, I mean, a century ago, right, people were talking about super males, if they had two Y chromosomes, that might have led them to be more violent, for example. There was no proof to that whatsoever. So do you worry that there may be some, maybe not in the scientific community, but those of us outside of it who are trying to interpret the findings, a yearning to say, well, we can understand these aspects of masculinity because of what we find on the Y?
Yeah, I think there's a real human need to try and find like the answer to various things and just explain it. And if there are science, you know, science-y words that you can use. And I think it's true for genetics. And I mentioned earlier the hunt for the so-called gay gene. But it's also true of things like hormones. So testosterone, androgens are triggered by the chromosome. What does that mean? And clearly that has an effect on behavior. But it's also clear that culture and environment interact with those differences in biology in ways that make culture more important. So understanding biology, even understanding something like the role of hormones, doesn't make culture less important. It makes it more important. So, for example, if as a result of the testosterone and androgen production that comes from the Y chromosome, men have more potential for physical aggression, which is true, that doesn't mean that men are physically aggressive. Look at what's happened in the last few decades. Look at one country compared to another country, right? Mm. The levels of male aggression vary significantly. And so actually, the thing is that if you're like a more of a men's rights person and you're looking for a genetic explanation for like male superiority, the more we learn about the Y chromosome, the weaker that argument gets, right? It's not the super chromosome. It's, if anything, a little bit of a weakling chromosome. Mm-hmm. And that can be used on the other side to sort of be eye-rollingly dismissive of men. And the truth is that we're just all a little bit sometimes entranced by the possibility of a biological explanation. And whilst I think it's a mistake not to understand the biological roots of human behavior, it is also a mistake to overweight it, mm-hmm. right? To think that that's the allele for whatever. When it comes to things like behavior, so the difference between maleness as a biological condition and what that means for, say, testicular cancer or fertility or some of the things that we heard, that's important. But masculinity is and always has been much more of a social construction, much more of a cultural construction, varying over time and place. And it's super interesting to me, actually, that there's a lot, there's more variation on the Y than right. on the X. I mean, I thought, wasn't that interesting? That
totally fascinating.
No one really knows why, but by way of analogy rather than causality, I would say, well, in a way, that's sort of a hopeful finding, because what it suggests is that maybe there's also lots of variability in masculinity and that it's not fixed either in time or place, or fixed in some way deep, deep, deep within our DNA, without denying the fact that there are some differences. So I love this way of talking about it, the way you've just been talking about it for the last hour or so, which is, look, biology matters, understanding it matters, health matters for everybody, men and women. But also when it comes to sort of the social questions, of women and men and how we behave and, who should be president and who can be nurses, we're not going to find that on a DNA map.
Yeah. Right? So not overweighting the importance of genetics is critical here, but I'd also say not underweighting it is important, because so many chapters of your book put together the research that shows that, for example, in early education, when you came on the show, we talked about this a lot, that there is kind of on average, right? There'll always be outliers on either side of a curve, but on average, boys in K through five, they learn at different rates in different subjects than the girls do. And so maybe, you've advocated like taking another look at what's expected of kids in early education, especially of boys, or maybe changing the thinking around how to best educate boys. When you have that kind of on average difference, it can't exclusively be environment, right? I still think we have to understand the genetic part played here.
I agree, and the understandable fear of looking at biology, looking at these differences in biology that are related to behavior, is that it will be used in some way to discriminate against a certain group. Mm-hmm. And of course, historically, against women. And so actually, we've had this understandable fear that we're going to in some way treat females like defective males. And it took quite a long time to make sure that women were even included in clinical trials of drugs, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's equally important that we don't make the opposite mistake of saying men are defective females and sort of what's different about. So what we want is a way of thinking about this from every level, from the very biological roots of our existence, DNA, up to what's happening in society, which is cognizant of these on average differences without being trapped by them. They can become traps and they can become excuses for discrimination. And so I think for a lot of people, they're understandably wary of anything that explains anything by biology because of how it's been used historically. But we're not there anymore. And it's very important that we're able to have a good faith conversation about the actual evidence and not treat just because boys are different to girls, say, in at the age of five, or men have some differences to women at the age of 50. And we've just heard a lot about those. It doesn't mean one's better than the other. It just means we are different. And can we have equality without androgyny? That's the test, I think, in front of us. And this science should help us in that course.
Yeah. I will say also that it is quite exciting to see if, as research progresses, we do find Y-associated reasons for, the health differences that we were talking about that men do face, especially in later age. So Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men and author of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. Thank you so very much for coming back to the show, Richard.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.